This is Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned now for a special live update on the coronavirus with Dr. Drew Colfax and Dr. John Rochaw. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So bring us up to date. The last time we had one of these updates was Saturday afternoon. So Dr. Colfax, why don't you tell us what's the latest?
So in the county, we have sent 99 tests so far. One has come back positive. It's the same one I reported on and Dr. Doohan reported on several days ago. There have been no additional positive tests, and approximately half are still pending results. I just came from work in the emergency room moments ago, and I can report that we are now clinically seeing people that we think are having mild symptoms of coronavirus, and we are telling people this, and we're urging that they treat it like a viral syndrome, that they self-isolate.
Live from NP.
Return if they start developing more dangerous or worrisome symptoms. We are generally not testing anybody in the community unless they meet certain fairly rigid criteria. And even then, we're generally only testing people to clear essential personnel to get back to work more quickly. So it's mostly going to be sheriffs, law enforcement, paramedics, people who work in the hospital. If they come back with a negative test, then we can let them get back to work more quickly. Because one of our grave ongoing concerns is we're simply going to run out of personnel if we have to quarantine everybody who develops a fever over the course of the next week or two. So that's sort of the local update. Nationally, I think just today we crossed the threshold of over 100 deaths in one day in this country. Over 8,000 cases are being diagnosed a day, which must be understood in the context of the fact that the vast majority of people who have this have not been tested. So even though we have diagnosed 8,000 new cases in the last 24 hours in this country, the actual number is certainly many times higher, and it's probably on the order of 100 or even 200 times higher than that number. We just really don't have a good handle on how many actual cases there are. We can look to the situation in New York, where they are quickly overrunning the healthcare system, as an indicator of why this social distancing is so critical.
And that is most people's experience right now in the county is experiencing social distancing, staying home, only going out very limited times when it's absolutely necessary.
Right. I've actually mentioned this to numerous patients. It's like, we're a rural county. We know how to do social distancing. Do what you're good at. So I think we're in a unique situation versus the urban areas to be able to do this.
Yeah, and that is the voice of Dr. John Rochaw, primary care provider at Anderson Valley Health Center, and Dr. Drew Colfax, who's an ER physician at the Ukiah Adventist Hospital. So you guys are really on the front lines of this this response to this pandemic here locally.
Yes. And, you know, fortunately, we haven't started seeing the sick patients that we're anticipating from this. We are preparing. Both the hospital in Ukiah and clinics are preparing to ramp up capacity, as well as the Department of Health. Yeah, our capacity, however, really depends on people distancing to slow the rate of transmission so not everybody gets sick during the same five-day period. We need to spread this out over several weeks at least.
Right, and we can do that. We have the ability to do that. So I don't think there's anything unique about the measures that we need to take to make this happen. What I would tell you personally is I've made it a point to actually reach out to people I don't necessarily see enough on a regular basis without a virus going on to make an extra effort to reach out to people and not be socially isolated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as this goes forward and as it becomes a bit tiresome and increasingly burdensome, and as more and more people become unemployed, the anxiety and the stress of this is going to only grow. It's going to become also a bit cognitively confusing because we really don't see a lot of morbidity from this currently. It's not as though this is a forest fire where we can't breathe and we can't see because of the smoke. This is still a very abstract threat that we are talking incessantly about and destroying both the state, local, and national economy. But it hasn't really touched us in a significant personal way yet here.
Drew, I would add something even more important to that. With success, it will be more confusing. We have what we call a negative proof here. So the better we are at socially isolating, the less we will see evidence of a problem. So we won't necessarily get reinforcement of a lot of people being sick, hopefully.
Correct. And you call it a negative proof. I just call it irony. If we're really good at this, we're going to be called hysterics because there won't ever be a crisis in this county.
So, right. So don't wait till you see it. Yeah. Hopefully you never see it.
So, and while we're talking about, getting really sick, John, you're trained as an oncologist. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the patients that are even at greater risk. I think most of the listeners recognize that the risk goes up as we get older. But are there other groups of patients with other conditions that should be especially vigilant?
Right. I've been an oncologist for 30 years. But also work with immunosuppressed patients in rheumatology, for example. And so these people have a normally difficult life. These people may be a little bit ahead of the rest of you in that they're used to improving their hygiene out of necessity. But what they really need from the rest of us is they need the rest of us to not overwhelm the health system that they already depend on. So we're not sure of all the cofactors that make it difficult. I have said for decades that the oncology clinic in the winter was a hard time because of influenza. So what do we do in oncology clinics during influenza? We proceed and we try to keep influenza from infecting other patients, but there's really nothing that we do specifically once someone has it in those clinics. We do know that certain comorbidities are making coronavirus more virile. So we know that chronic kidney disease, and we know that congestive heart failure, and we know that smoking and vaping, and we know that morbid obesity are all pointed out as risk factors for making COVID-19 that much more virulent. I haven't seen cancer specifically make the list, but it can't be far. So, yeah, and my main plea to everyone is to help us preserve the system that these patients already depend on.
Yeah, and I think that's also sort of the main plea and sort of one of the driving forces behind the social distancing, just to preserve the healthcare system to allow it to function. New York is really teetering on the brink of catastrophe from what I can see. They're just being overwhelmed with tens of thousands of patients. And that's a large, obviously a very, very large healthcare system that can integrate and move resources around. We really don't have that luxury in this county. We have a very tiny healthcare system that has, resources that are stretched pretty thin on the best of days and very limited capacity to transfer patients out when we're not in the midst of a pandemic. So we really have to take care of our own and reserve our fairly stretched resources through this pandemic.
Yeah, I would say a lot of kudos to the Anderson Valley Health Clinic, where I work, for rolling out different approaches to patient care and the emphasis to please call and let us talk about things before you come see us. But telehealth is here.
Yeah.
So we know that necessity is the mother of invention. She is hard at work right now, which is great. So utilize those technologies. We also do recognize that many of our patients, many of our community are not internet connected. They're not smartphone connected. And we're having to come up with creative ways of helping those people just as well.
Right. And I can say from having come from the emergency room just now that the phone is ringing probably every 10 to 15 minutes with somebody calling to see if they should come in to be checked. And in general, the answer is no, you don't need to come in.
Right.
I mean, obviously we are saying you're welcome to come in if you think you absolutely need to come in. But speaking as a doctor on the radio rather than as a physician on behalf of Adventist or the County Department of Public Health, in general, if you feel okay and you feel like you have the flu or the cold, then it is okay to treat it as such at home and stay at home with it. You don't need to come in to be told that you presumptively have the coronavirus.
And influenza is currently active in our community. It is here, as well as several other viruses. So there's a very good chance you can have those as well.
And we had been hoping to be able to rely on testing people for influenza and then telling them that they don't have coronavirus, but that data is becoming a bit more muddled. So in general, if people look okay, we tell them to just stay hydrated and stay at home and come back, obviously, when you start to have shortness of breath or chest pain or if you become short of breath with walking or get lightheaded or feel like you're decompensating. But if you're the walking well and the walking worried well, it's okay to just seek reassurance and stay at home.
All right. Well, one of the things we're trying to do with these regular updates is give people a chance to call in. Are you guys ready to open up the phone lines? The number here in the studio is 895-2448. That's 707-895-2448 if you'd like to call and talk with Dr. Drew Colfax or Dr. John Rocha. We also put out the call that people could send in questions via email, and we do have some questions, so we'll start with those. Our listener emails, with the shortage of gloves, masks, etc., when using disposable gloves, is it feasible to just wash or disinfect hands with the gloves on instead of throwing them away after each use? And if I have a stash of N95 masks, which so many of us had during the fires, could we donate them in an already open box to either our local clinic or hospital? Many thanks.
So, you know, going through medical school, the rule when we were learning how to repair lacerations was solution is the solution to pollution, which is to say you use water to wash away the dirt or the bacteria or the virus. So in general, soap and water is going to clean your skin just as well as those gloves. So yes, you can wash them in soapy water. If you want to be hypervigilant, you can even do it in a dilute betadine or chlorine solution. That will kill the virus to the end of any risk of infectivity. As for the N95s, yeah, we will take them because we need not just N95s, but we're also trying to preserve all the other equipment that we need to keep ourselves safe and keep other people from contracting it from us. So obviously I don't think very many people have the gowns and the gloves and everything else that you need to prevent contagion. But we're working pretty hard both at the county and at the hospital level to get those supplies bolstered here.
There is information out that washing N95s are solutions used to cleanse ethanol, rubbing alcohol, etc. in N95 is a bad idea.
Yeah, I don't think you can wash the masks, but latex gloves or rubber gloves, right. I presume you can wash.
All right. Let's take a phone question. Good afternoon, caller. You're live on the air.
Good afternoon. I have actually a story and a question. I'll do the story first. My immediate neighbors with whom I normally have contact about a month ago got what was considered a heavy flu. They had fever. They had terrible earaches, etc., etc. Father and son and another neighbor who is immediate. They self-isolated, kept away from everybody, dosed themselves, and got through it. And now when they're hearing all the stories, they're wondering if perhaps they had the virus, because it sounds as if they did. And my question is, a number of years ago, I got a pneumonia shot. Does that protect me now? And I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks for the questions.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
The pneumonia shot, the Pneumovax, or PPSV 23, will protect against 23 different antigens associated with the pneumonia, pneumococcal pneumonia. Unfortunately, it will not protect you against any virus whatsoever. That said, I would add that having a Pneumovax would protect you from having pneumonia, which may make you susceptible to COVID-19 if you were otherwise exposed. So back to the discussion about comorbidities or having concurrent illnesses and what we were saying about testing people for influenza and COVID, it would still be to your benefit to have that Pneumovax, but it won't help you specifically.
And frankly, I'm not sure that the at this point is outweighed by the risk of your presenting to a health center to get the vaccine.
Right.
So if you do not have the Pneumovax, do not get it this next week on an emergent basis.
Same for influenza.
Yeah. But in general, you know, I think Dr. Rocha and I will be strong advocates for the annual influenza vaccine as well as the Pneumovax vaccine.
Yes, this is a really difficult way for our community to learn about influenza vaccinations. We had that power. We squandered it in some ways. That makes Drew's and my job more difficult to sort out what people do have. And no one's saying that flu shot is perfect.
And to go back to the story, at this point, I would not presume that the people, your neighbors, would have had the coronavirus. It simply was that was too early in this pandemic for them to have those symptoms and get through it, unless they had come off a cruise ship or come from Wuhan, China, or something
right.
like that.
But really good timing.
Yeah.
All right, we've got another call. Good afternoon, caller. You're live on KZYX.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Yeah. So I have really bad allergies every season, and I've been prescribed the Qvar inhaler and loratadine. Also, sometimes take the Flonase, and I'm just wondering, is it a better idea to stop taking my allergy meds because they suppress my immune system, or is it better to avoid the effects of inflammation from my allergies?
Well, I would say that loratadine is an antihistamine, so it's not involved in your immune system. Qvar and Flonase are both what we call corticosteroids that can minimally suppress, and especially in that topical form, a part of your immune system, not your immune system as a whole. I would say you're at no significant risk to continue those, and it would be really nice to be able to sort out your symptoms and manage an early pollen season right now.
And Dr. Rocha, you might have different information, but my understanding the last I looked at it is that all people should continue all of their chronic medications.
Correct.
There's really nothing out there to recommend that anybody stop taking any of their chronically prescribed medications.
Correct. Don't add, don't subtract.
Even though we're reading all of these horror stories on the internet right now.
Yeah. I really would avoid the internet. I would choose one or two good, reliable news sources and stick with those.
True. I've actually taken an opposite approach recently in clinic, and it's been very effective. When someone asks me a question like this, I'm like, well, let's go to the internet and see what kinds of crazy things go in there. And it's actually been very instructional. It's kind of the antidote we need in some ways to the craziness. So I would say feel free to look at the internet if you need a good laugh. But it's, yes, like Drew says, find a few reliable sources and the rest is entertainment.
Right. As long as you treat it as entertainment and it doesn't drive anxiety, because
right.
I think there's a real risk of becoming misinformed and it just can exacerbate anxiety.
Yeah, but don't be surprised if you read it on the internet. It's there.
It's all there.
Great. Good point, because we are doing that in order to keep ourselves connected and seeing a lot of scary stuff. So take it. Don't believe it. Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Yeah. I have a question. I haven't been able to get anywhere to find a thermometer. Is there any way to self-evaluate as to whether or not I have a fever? I'm a patient being treated. I have heart congestion, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and congestive heart failure. But so I'm always coughing. The question is whether I can self-evaluate for a fever or not, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
We actually looked into obtaining free thermometers to give out from the AVHC clinic, and they're 18-month back order. Those are the medical suppliers. This weekend, I made a couple of trips in looking for thermometers. They're none. They're cleared off, like he says. I don't know of a good situation.
Yeah, I think everything's been sort of bought in mass from all the local pharmacies, frankly, unfortunately. So if you feel like you're running a fever, if you have the characteristic chills and sweats and weakness and fatigue, then particularly get risk factors, I would present to medical attention, whether it be in the emergency room or at your local clinic. But somebody should probably lay eyes on you and get some vital signs. And they might say you're fine and send you on your way. But I think given the fact that you have significant risk factors for getting fairly ill from this disease.
It's a good point also to those of you who do have thermometers. Don't forget to check if you feel chilled. That's often a fever that we miss. And no, I'll add to other things I've heard recently, 5 blankets on top of you will not give you a fever. It's not possible. Please don't check your temperature after hot coffee. What other things do I hear, Drew?
I've heard them all. I really have. I mean, but while we're talking about signs and symptoms of this disease, it bears keeping in mind, which is what makes this disease so difficult to contain, that a significant number of us are going to have no symptoms at all. And we're going to be walking around completely asymptomatic, giving it to everybody that we come into contact with. And so that's really the rationale for this draconian shutdown that we're seeing both locally and nationally.
All right. We have more callers. The lines are
lit up.
Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Hi. Thanks again for doing this. I heard another radio show where a doctor was curious about losartan being able to be the angiotensin blocker that would be helpful for the lung issues that come up so horribly with this infection. I was wondering if you had any input on that.
Absolutely. My subspecialty in oncology is HIV immunologic oncology. It appears that the primary molecular target for coronavirus, novel coronavirus, is actually ACE2. That's different. So the studies thus far have shown no efficacy from any current medication that's available. So no losartan and its relatives will not be helpful. You should not be taking losartan if you're not already on it for another reason. And we're worried about people who have blood pressure controlled on losartan being able to get it. So we don't need a different panic buying.
Oh, boy. Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
And as of now, and this is a rapidly evolving situation, the treatment for this is still what we call supportive. We help people's breathing. We help people's blood pressure. We give them fluids. But there's really not any medicine specific that changes the course of this disease, unfortunately. And believe me, people are spending a lot of time and a lot of money trying to find the answer because, the faster we get to the answer, the faster this thing can be controlled.
All right. We have another call. Hello, caller. You're live on the air.
Hello.
It's you. Yep.
So I have a question to either one of the gentlemen, I suppose. I'm curious, kind of the disparity, I guess, between CDC and WHO and what they're saying. WHO is quote unquote, we have not seen urgent enough escalation in testing, isolation, and contact tracing, which is the backbone of the response. We have a simple message for all countries: test, test, test. Test every suspected case. If they test positive, isolate them. Find who they came in contact with 2 days before they develop symptoms and test those people too. And isn't the reality of it that we're not testing simply because California doesn't have enough medical supplies? And kind of the storyline you guys are putting out there is based on that, not based on the best methodology of dealing with this crisis.
Right. So I take your point, and it's really one that I've heard from a lot of different people, both within and without of the hospital. The short answer is we needed a lot of tests early on in this outbreak, before it became a pandemic even. We needed very aggressive testing and contact tracing, which is where you find every person who could possibly have come into contact with that test positive individual and test and quarantine all of those people. And that's the way you can box off and stop one of these pandemics from developing. I can tell you, however, now when we're talking about 8,000 new cases a day, documented cases a day, that the ability to test our way out of this pandemic is long gone. It would have been nice. It would have been imperative to have these tests 6 weeks and 8 weeks ago. And the government messed that up, but it is way too late now, which is why we're in this mitigation phase of the pandemic, where we're trying to restrict the growth of the pandemic. John, do you have anything else to add to that?
Right. That would change if we actually had a therapy.
Right. And that's another good point. It's right. So if we had something that we could give somebody when their test was positive, then that might change our need or our urgency around getting the tests. But right now, if somebody looks good and we think they might have it, then they presumptively have it and they need to stay home. And additionally, and this really doesn't make it much into the popular press, we don't know how good these tests are. So these tests are not – no test is 100% sensitive or specific, which means to say that if you tested 100 people who actually had the disease – a 100% sensitive test would pick up all those people. This test, our best estimate is it's in the 80% range for both of those measures. It might be a little better, might be a little worse, which means it's going to tell you you don't have the disease when, in fact, you do have it 20% of the time. And it's going to tell you you don't have it when, in fact, you do have it 20% of the time.
Not different from anything we do in medicine.
Correct. So, you know, the rule in at least my line of medicine is if you're not going to change management on the basis of the test, don't get the test. And at this point, unfortunately, we're just past the point where testing is relevant.
It's more of a fascinoma, say, we're counting numbers.
Well, it's important. You know, my brother is director of public health in San Francisco, and he is about to do 200 surveillance tests just in the general population, just to get a sense of how prevalent it is in the population. It's not going to change the management of those 200 people one iota, but that will give him a sense of how widespread it is. And then he'll do that again in another probably 5 days or 7 days, and he'll do it again after that. It's a public health issue getting the test at this point, but it's not an individual care issue.
Well, it would be nice as workers to know that we didn't have it so we could go back to work if we had some symptoms.
Right. And so there are a few people that need to be, you know, sort of mobilized to provide care that will be getting tested. But it's really going to be a very limited cohort of people in this county.
All right. Let's see if we can get this last call. Hello, caller. Oops. Hello. Oh. Turn your radio off, please.
Yeah, I just did.
Okay, good. Whew. Go ahead.
I have a question about other pandemics that are happening in the world right now. It was drawn to my attention that tuberculosis is the number one infectious disease that is also a pandemic, and I hadn't really thought about TB for years until I compared it to what's happening now with coronavirus. And apparently it is killing about 16 times the rate of coronavirus. Can you help me put this in perspective?
All right, thanks for that call. I'm going to drop the call, and we just have about a minute left.
I'm not sure about the actual statistics. I would say that that curve is a little flatter, which we're talking about. So it's been a chronic pandemic around this world. We have been wonderfully spared for the most part in the United States. We actually have therapies for tuberculosis? I don't think we're talking about the same type of disorder.
I think there are also a couple other key distinctions. Tuberculosis is actually fairly hard to transmit to one another. And it's a very slow-growing organism. A culture on the tuberculosis organism takes 2 weeks because it grows so slowly.
Or more.
And so it means that it doesn't cause disease very quickly. So it doesn't have the capacity to move through a population in a sort of tsunami kind of fashion that this COVID-19 does. You know, tuberculosis is certainly a very serious disease in huge portions of the world, and efforts to contain it have really proven to be challenging because it's a very clever organism. It's able to develop resistance to drugs, and multiple resistance to drugs that makes it very hard to control.
Those probably are areas of the world where we'll see an especially high mortality rate from COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, when this gets to sort of areas of the world that does not have any health care or any meaningful health care, like Africa, it's just going to be devastating if it sweeps through there.
All right. Well, that takes us to the bottom of the hour. It's 3:30. We have the phone lines still lighting up. So to the question of whether or not this is useful or valuable for listeners, I think the answer is clearly yes. So hopefully we can have you come back tomorrow. Have you back on at 3 for more phone calls.
And I will be trying to roust a rotating cast of characters in here to co-host with me, so it's not just my voice that people hear droning on and on and on and on.
No, we really appreciate you coming in and answering questions. And Dr. Drew Colfax, Dr. John Rocha, thank you so much. And we just couldn't be more grateful that you are willing to do this for the community. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alicia.
All right. We are going to join Reveal in Progress and go back to our regularly scheduled programming. And we'll be back tomorrow at 3 with more live coronavirus information and call-ins.